Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Stetson University in DeLand, Florida, has formally recognized how important some students regard their pets. Dogs, cats, and other small pets are now permitted as roommates for students in certain pet-friendly dorms.
So if they can bring Fido, or one of the Fidos, the family pet, with them to school, it's going to help with that transition and really help with them feeling comfortable.
That's Rena Tovar, then Vice President of Campus Life at Stetson. So how have we come to this, making pets a priority for college freshmen? And is that going just a little bit too far? Dogs are so important to many of us that they can even come between us and the humans we're supposed to love and cherish. What's going on with that? And then there's the family bed, the one that welcomes dogs, the dog at night. What happens when the person who approves of that marries the person who doesn't? Coming up later, we'll hear from a cultural sociologist on that matter. And to our listeners, we'd like to hear from you. Tell us if a pet has come between you and a loved one. Let us know how the situation was resolved. You can give us a call at 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Right now, we welcome Jennifer Brandt, who has a Ph.D. in social work, which she practices, of all places, in the OSU College of Veterinary Medicine. Welcome to the show, Jennifer.
Thank you very much.
Also joining us from Florida is Chris Candace. He's the Dean of Student Affairs at Stetson University. Chris, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
So it's that report that we heard from a little earlier with Rena Tovar, that was from last spring. You're now edging up on the end of your first year with this.
Yes, we are.
How's it going?
We've had a lot of success. It's been great. I think what Rena said kind of still fits the bill for what's happening for us right now. Our students are feeling in the hall that has the pets available very much more transitioned and adjusted to the college environment because they've been able to bring a little piece of home with them. So we've had a lot of success.
Well, it's a big piece of home. How has it been as far as maintenance with the – are most of them dogs? Can you give me an idea of what different kinds of pets the students have brought?
Most of the pets are dogs. We do have a few students who have brought fish, rabbits. We have a ferret, but mainly dogs and cats.
And do they have to be pets that were in the home they came from? I mean, it can't be like they went out and bought a new puppy to come to college with.
You know, most of the students have brought pets from home that have already been with their family established. And then there's been a few students who have decided to adopt new pets from shelters and to bring it in. So it's been a combination.
How do you make sure that the benefit to the students who have brought their pets doesn't impinge on the rights and the happiness of students who don't have pets there?
You know, we were very careful about that. We didn't want people that had allergies or people that were not pet friendly at all to be influenced in that way. We didn't want to take away their experience. So that's why we were really focused about putting the pets in a residence hall where it would just be students and pets. And the way this residence hall is set up, it's kind of a smaller building that is individual single rooms, so the student has them and their pet, and then other people around them are either really, really pet friendly and excited to be around pets or have pets of their own. So it really kind of isolates them a little bit, so they're not infringing upon other people's experiences.
How are you measuring success in this case?
You know, that's a great question. We're expanding what our program is called at Living Learning Communities, and this is where the pet hall falls into. And we are working with the students and developing goals that they see. Like, how do you measure success? Each student's experience is going to be a little bit different. So for me to say the goal of having no one have an accident in their room or no one to get bit by an animal or people just to be happier is, I think, an unrealistic goal. So what we've been trying to do is work with the students individually, and we'll be doing that more in the future, about how do you measure success with this? How has this really affected your college career? How has it made it better for you? Why do you feel, what are the benefits are for having a pet in the hall? So it's a work in progress, but it's hard to measure success because I think it's really individually based.
How many dogs in all do you have in the dorm now?
We have 10 dogs in the residence hall and 9 cats.
Is there enough space in the residence hall for all the students who want to participate in this, or is it holding its own right now?
It's a great question. We're actually doing great. We're expanding next year our pet residence hall capabilities. So we'll be adding a whole nother wing in that building. So we'll be doubling our occupancy for students to have pets on campus.
Chris, what first inspired the university to consider an option like this for students?
Sure. Our current president, Dr. Wendy Libby, she's a huge pet advocate, and she had actually done this at her previous institution. So when she became the president here at Stetson, she brought the idea with her. So I really have to give all the credit to her about putting this in place.
All right. Chris Candace, he is a dean of students at Stetson University, where they have a pet-friendly dorm. They just started it this year. And thank you so much for joining us, Chris.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. And back to Jennifer Brandt. She's at the OSU College of Veterinary Medicine, and she is not, she's not even a, you don't even give shots. You don't even clip nails. You're strictly.
I am there for the people.
You're a social worker. Tell us, how did you wind up in the College of Veterinary Medicine as a social worker, PhD social worker?
My background really is working with families who have been victims of domestic violence or some other trauma. And even in my PhD research, I was able to look at the role that in trying to keep animals safe prevented women from maybe being able to leave a violent relationship. And I think through that, I had opportunities to meet some folks at the College of Veterinary Medicine, and they were a very progressive bunch. They said, what do you think about coming on board and working with us and helping educate us to interact with our clients and offer support to people who may be grieving? So I came on board about 13 years ago.
So you help with the grieving process, and I've had a really positive experience with veterinarians when I've lost pets. It's really amazing how much thought and consideration they put into it. Is that the sort of thing you work on, is helping them help their clients cope?
It really is, and we get that feedback from a lot of folks that say they wish their human family members have been treated as well in a crisis as their pets and they were through the process. And that is a lot of the support that I offer. And we take our commitment to educating veterinarians in terms of their responsibility to public health very seriously. So working with veterinarians and our students on how to educate clients about important issues.
Like abuse, neglect?
It can be. The link between domestic violence, child abuse, and animal abuse. So being aware of, you know, maybe if a story doesn't match up that a client brings in, to know to ask some questions and find out a little bit more about the home situation. You know, even elderly folks, helping them maintain the relationship with their pet, even though it may be more difficult to come to a veterinarian and receive regular wellness checks for their pet.
My guest is Jennifer Brandt. She's a social worker at the OSU College of Veterinary Medicine. We're talking about the human relationship, the relationships that humans have with their pets, particularly dogs and cats seem to be the most sentient among them. 614-292-8513. If you want to give us a call, and if you have any questions or comments for Jennifer, please do, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Do you, in particular, we're interested in the kinds of pet relationships that sometimes can come between the humans. Is the pet more important in your family? Are there arguments over whether the pet sleeps on the bed or not? Are there arguments about how the pet is treated? Have there been, and have you resolved it? And most importantly, give us a call, 614-292-8513. What do you think about the idea at Stetson University of having students bring pets with them to school?
I think it's a wonderful program. You know, we often hear from students all around the university how much that would make the transition easier. Many describe that transition to college as sometimes being very lonely and being very scary. And they say when they can go home to a pet, it really does make life easier. Somebody's happy to greet them at the end of the day. And that somebody, in this case a pet, doesn't worry about whether or not they're the top of the class or not. They just are there to support them.
You know, the program is mostly about the really strong connection that humans have with their pets. But you said earlier that you got started in the line of work you're in now because of the dysfunction that people can have with their pets.
True.
What happens? What is it about somebody who can kick a dog when it's down?
I think some of those behaviors you can notice very early on. You know, we might notice children with aggressive behaviors toward animals, and sometimes if that isn't addressed, then that escalates to people. And what we find is that sometimes aggression against pets, once that barrier is broken, it's much easier to translate that to people.
What about people? We're going to have David Bluen from Indiana University, South Bend. He's a cultural sociologist and kind of will talk to us about that larger societal relationship with our pets. But what is there a tipping point where someone's really involved with their pet and they really love their pet a lot, and where you might be concerned about that it's too much of a good thing?
That's a really good question. And yes, in terms of identifying folks who may be at risk for complicated mourning, perhaps after the death of a pet, mm-hmm. we know from the research that that might be approximately 30% of folks who face euthanasia of their pet. And there are a host of risk factors, including the role that that pet has played. Did they give the animal human qualities? Did they maybe have that pet come into their life at a key point in their life? Many clients will say, this is the animal that got me through a divorce, breast cancer, the death of a child. And so those attachments are special and sometimes can create more challenging grief for the person who's experiencing the loss.
So the complicated mourning, define complicated mourning. How do you measure that?
We measure it. We can measure it through qualitative studies and responses to surveys in terms of people do grieve after a loss, and that's healthy and normal. And it's healthy and normal to grieve after the death of a pet, although society doesn't necessarily support that. But we look at, does the grief start to impact their ability to perform daily functions? Does it impact their desire to get up or eat or interact with loved ones or go to work? And for some folks, the grief is so paralyzing that they're not able to do that, and that would be concerning.
So when you talk about that sort of after the fact, is it, when you train and you talk with, you know, vets in training about this process, is this something they should be looking at beforehand? So
yes.
When they're talking about a sick animal, that they can start to see some signs of coping or lack thereof?
Absolutely. In fact, we talk about that the model we want to make sure we move away from is trying to have these types of intense conversations with clients in the moment of crisis. The best time to have them is actually well before, when the client's able to hear the information. Perhaps it's an early diagnosis of a terminal illness, to talk about what the owner views quality of life, what that will look like. So in some ways, they almost form a contract with their pet that when life isn't fun anymore, when you have more bad days than good, then we can talk about other treatment options, including euthanasia. So the earlier we can provide the education and support, the better.
My guest is Jennifer Branch. She has a PhD in social work, and she practices in the OSU College of Veterinary Medicine. She's going to come back with us when we return after this break. And joining us as well is a cultural sociologist who studies human relationships, humans and their relationships with pets. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.
Good morning, I'm Eric French. 65 degrees right now and partly cloudy. Showers and thunderstorms likely today with a high reaching 70 degrees and dropping to 48 tonight with a chance of thunderstorms. More rain and storms likely tomorrow with a high of 56 degrees.
I'm Tom Ashbrook, host of NPR's On Point. We always say On Point is about what's news, but it's also about what's now, about all that matters now, not just politics, war, recession. You've got to have beauty, joy. You've got to have the unexpected. Come see what we're all about. Join us for the next On Point.
On Point is 1 o'clock today on 89.7 NPR News.
Support for 89.7 comes from the McCoy Center for the Arts. The 2011 lecture series continues with American Politics at the Breaking Point, looking at the relationship between media and politics, Tuesday, March 22nd at 7 p.m. Details at mccoycenter.org.
Welcome back to All Sides. With us still is Jennifer Brandt, social worker in the OSU College of Veterinary Medicine. Joining us now is David Bluen. David teaches sociology at Indiana University in South Bend, where, among other things, he studies human-animal relations and the role of animals in American families. David Bluen, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Tell us about the major turning points in human-animal relationships. Have we always let them sleep in bed with us?
That's a very good question, but also a complicated one. I guess I would start with about 10 or 12,000 years ago. It's about when we started involving animals in our societies in a big way, as pets and also as a source of food, use them in hunting and that sort of thing. More what I look at is obviously what's going on right now, and I would say, at least in the Western world, over the last 100, 200, 300 years, the end of the 1700s, mid to late 1800s, I think we saw a pretty major shift. And that's the time in which the middle class in Europe as well as in the United States, a little bit later in the United States, but the middle class became pretty highly involved in pet keeping for the first time. Before that, it wasn't popular at all. You had some elites, monarchies, religious leaders, that sort of thing, who did keep pets. But it wasn't until that time that it became kind of a more widely held practice, especially among the middle class. Around that same time, I think, not coincidentally, kind of the animal rights, animal welfare movement began to develop as well. So as people had more contact with animals in this way as pets, they became more concerned about their welfare and their treatment.
You break human interaction with pets or animals and domesticated animals, I guess, into three kind of major categories.
Right. I do. So I conducted a number of interviews with dog owners in particular. And I didn't necessarily expect this going in, but I was interested in talking with them because I had certainly noticed in reading and my own experiences with people that there are quite a few variations in how people not only think of their animals, but how they treat them, whether they are part of whether they consider them part of the family or not. So I did these interviews with people, and as you mentioned, these three different categories definitely emerged, and I call them humanists, protectionists, and dominionists. And the three categories are the humanists are those people who have these intense kind of emotional attachments to their animals. They consider them their friends and probably more commonly their children. They may be the pet owners we think of as perhaps spoiling their animals. They stay in the house almost always, sleep in their beds, that sort of thing. The protectionists were people who also had, in most cases, pretty intense kind of attachments to their animals, but their regard for their own animals was tied more toward this kind of universal concern for animal rights or animal welfare rather than just that particular relationship that they had with their animal or their animals. So as a result, some of their interactions and thoughts about their animals differed somewhat from those humanists. They were more often thinking about or at least talked about what was best for the animals. So there were some people I spoke with who felt like, dogs are very different from humans and had very different needs. And so they did not have their animals stay in the house. They had them stay outside. Maybe they even let them roam if they lived if they lived in rural areas and that sort of thing. The third category, which I called dominionists, were those people who had kind of a more utilitarian relationship with pets. They were interested in having dogs and having relationships with dogs because they found them useful in some way. Maybe it was a hunting dog. Maybe they had them primarily to protect their property. But it was a different type of attachment. It was definitely a different type of relationship than I witnessed or heard about from the humanists and the protectionists.
Jennifer Brandt, what happens when a dominionist marries a humanist?
a high need for communication, I would say. And that happens very commonly. We'll often hear that from folks, maybe even depending on how they grew up. I can tell you my own husband grew up in a family where animals were not in the house. They had a dog. It was kept outside. I grew up in a family where animals owned the house and we were allowed to live there. But we were able to communicate through that. And fortunately, my husband came around to my way of thinking on that. But, you know, many families do have to work out the boundaries. And what we encourage in terms of the veterinary field is that families have those discussions before an animal is brought in. Because once the animal is in the home, it may be hard to assert some rules if there are different opinions about that in terms of, is it an indoor animal, an outdoor animal? What do they have access to in the house? Will it be allowed on the furniture, et cetera?
David, you study, you know, animals in the role of animals in American families. What have you come across? You've done some in-depth interviews with, what is it, 24 or 25 different families about their pets. What are you finding about the incidence of people marrying a different kind of a dog person or a different kind of a cat person for that matter?
Right. As Jennifer mentioned, it definitely happens, and I think happens a lot. Most of the interviews I did were with individuals, but a handful of them, I think five or six, were with couples. And these types of issues came up quite a bit. And in some cases, yes, the two people are completely on board, and they kind of have the same views. And often they don't. So I agree with Jennifer. Communication is extremely important, and sometimes, you know, there is tension and conflict. And sometimes they work it out, sometimes they don't. I think when they generally don't work it out, usually it causes, you know, it may lead to, for example, the animal being let go or returned to the shelter, that sort of thing.
Is the categories that you spoke of, are those completely learned things? I mean, if you're going to be a dominionist, is that because you were raised a dominionist and that's the only way it can be? What do we know about how people adopt those or find themselves in those categories?
That's a very good question. And that's one thing I was definitely interested in. I think it's complicated. I think in some ways they are definitely learned. The way that people are brought up is obviously very influential in how they feel and relate to animals as adults, but people do change. You know, they may be influenced by a partner or by a particularly close friend, maybe even by a relationship with an animal. They may change their views. Another thing that I definitely noticed is that the structure of the family seems to be pretty important. So, for example, someone may have grown up in a family where grown up in more of a humanist family where they did have close relationships with dogs or cats. And then they became adults and they adopted a dog or a cat. As a single person, they got married perhaps and maybe started having children. Often the presence of children, I think, forces people or does encourage some people to change some of their views and change some of their orientations towards animals. I talked to quite a few people, for example, who said, you know, when I was single before I had children, my dogs, my cats were my kids, and I thought of them that way. But that all changed when I had human children. I also talked to people who had children, and then once their children moved out and they became empty nesters, their relationships with dogs or cats changed pretty dramatically, and they became humanists when they hadn't been in the past.
You know, Jennifer, I remember when I had my first dog app before, as an adult, before I had my child. And I said to somebody, this has been great training for the idea of getting ready to have children. And I remember this person was horrified that I said that. They thought, well, you're likening your children or your child or a child to an animal. And I said, well, yeah, when you put it that way, it sounds kind of weird, but isn't it
It is.
It's a lot of responsibility.
It is. It's an enormous amount of responsibility. And I know several students through the years who have said that very same thing. Let's start with a pet. Let's start small. Because it's not that somebody's trying to say that's a human. What they're trying to say is, I want to see if I can measure up to the extra accountability and the responsibility, and how does that fit into my life? And, you know, I encourage parents to say, it's not so much do you want a baby, but does the baby want you? You know, are you ready? And I think sometimes animals can provide some important training to let you see whether or not now's the right time for you.
My guests are Jennifer Brandt. She's a social worker at the OSU College of Veterinary Medicine. And also David Bluen at Indiana University in South Bend, where he studies human-animal relations and the role of animals in American families. If you have a question or comment for our guests, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. David, you study the role of animals in American families, so you must contrast that perhaps with other cultures, other places. And in general, is America, or is the United States becoming more pet friendly, or what?
Well, you know, I don't do a lot of cross-cultural research, although I do read some. Mm-hmm. The United States is not unique in this regard. In fact, I think there are some perhaps European countries where pets are maybe even higher valued at higher rates than they are in the United States. Mm-hmm. I think there's actually more variation in attitudes and relationships between humans and animals in the United States than you see in some other countries that maybe aren't quite as diverse as in the United States.
So are we along a continuum, and the Americans were changing toward our pets, or is it so slow that you really aren't going to notice any difference? In other words, are we going to start letting our pets come into restaurants with us someday?
Yes. In fact, I don't think that's uncommon at all in California, from what I understand. So one question I've been asked is this research was conducted in Indiana, and I've been asked, you know, does that, you know, introduce some bias into your results. And I guess I would say that I think that these variations in relationships exist everywhere, but the number of people in each category probably does vary from state to state or from place to place or, mm-hmm. you know, from Western country to Western country.
So from state to state, so you're saying that in California, for instance, they're more pet friendly, pets are more integrated in the everyday life.
Perhaps, yes. Yeah, I think that you would potentially see those kinds of differences, at least in different regions of the United States, or, you know, especially if you move from an urban area to a rural area.
You know, I guess I ask that partly, Jennifer, and, you know, maybe you can chime in, and David, there is a article in the New York Times about how pets are being used sort of in staging for apartments in New York City to sell apartments and condos and that kind of thing. You know, instead of the potpourri on the stove kind of a thing to make it sound like you're baking, you know, chocolate chip cookies or something like that, they're bringing a cat or a dog into the scene and making it look homier. Jennifer, you're chuckling.
I am. I think that's a creative idea. I just think it depends on your market. That may appeal to some, and it may be, you know, an instant turnoff from others who don't want to have a pet in their home and never wanted a pet previously in their home. But certainly if you want to promote a pet-friendly environment, that may be one way to do that.
David?
No, I agree completely. I mean, pets are extremely popular. Upwards of 60% of Americans have a dog or a cat. But there still is a big part of the population that don't have dogs and cats. And even among those who do, who may not have these kind of really highly attached emotional relationships with their dogs and cats. But there's obviously a big segment of the U.S. population that does and that would appeal to.
We have an email from Nigel. He writes, "The reason I feel more sad when I see a homeless cat or dog more than a homeless person is that animals are innocent. People have choices while our pets rely on us entirely for their health and safety. People let us down. Dogs don't. So I guess that's an interesting thing, because sometimes people are surprised that, you know, for instance, with Katrina, after Katrina hit, and even in Japan, of course, there's thousands of pets out there that are there that have been lost or are homeless right now, and people have wondered, who cares about a pet? Jennifer?
The reality is many people do, and what we really encourage folks to think about is to maybe lose the separation between living beings. And at the College of Veterinary Medicine, we often talk about one health or one medicine, and that often human health is linked to animal health. And so we want compassion for all vulnerable populations, whether that be pets or people, and the role that pets play in people's lives. I had an opportunity to lead a team down in Louisiana after Hurricane Katrina, and the devastation in people's lives because they had lost everything and now this attachment to a pet. You know, for many, that was just, they said, I can lose things, I can lose stuff, but to lose a loved one in my life, again, that being that was there all the time, was very hard for people to take, especially when they had to make a choice to either get out safely with their human loved ones, and in doing so, often having to purposely leave a pet behind. That was heartbreaking, and it was why social workers were included in the teams that went down to work with the survivors of Hurricane Katrina.
They're saying a lot of the people that stayed behind and perished were people who stayed behind because of their pets.
That's absolutely true. And I talked to family members who were in that situation, who had lost a loved one because their animals could not be gotten out safely.
My guests are David Bluen. He's at Indiana University South Bend, professor and a cultural sociologist, and also Jennifer Brandt. She is a social worker with the OSU College of Veterinary Medicine. If you have a question or comment for them, we're talking about our relationships with our pets. How deep does it go? You can give us a call at 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We're interested in hearing from our listeners who have struggled with relationships with pets, who have ended relationships perhaps with people over pets, or at least resolved, hopefully, their conflicts over the pets. Has a pet come between you and a loved one? Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We're going to take a break right now, and we'll return in just a few minutes. Stay with us. This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk about the final episode of HBO's Big Love with the show's creators, Mark Olson and Will Sheffer, who say it's going to be hard to let the characters go.
They are in your head 24/7. Yeah, you're on the toilet, the characters are talking in your head. You're shaving, the characters are in your head. You're doing the dishes, you're talking to the characters.
Join us.
I may not always love.
That's at noon on 89.7 NPR News. Connect with WOSU through one of our e-newsletters. Visit wosu.org/email and sign up to receive emails about our news programming, special events, classical music, and more. Connect with WOSU Public Media at wosu.org/email.
Brock Savakal's father knew that his son had changed after 3 tours in Iraq.
He was just absolutely terrified.
The Army got him help. Turns out it wasn't enough.
Put the gun down. Not worth it. I understand what you're trying to do. You're trying to bait us into shooting you, and it's not worth it.
An Iraq war vet goes over the edge. Later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered is at 4 p.m. today on 89.7 NPR News.
Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from the estate of Donald R. Glancy, whose life was enriched by public radio and television, and whose bequest seeks to encourage others to discover WOSU Public Media.
Welcome back to All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Talking about our relationships with our pets, how deep does it go, and has it ever caused strife in your family? Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. My guests for the balance of the hour, Dr. Jennifer Brandt. She has a PhD in social work from OSU, and of course she works in the College of Veterinary Medicine. Jennifer, thanks again for being with us today.
Thank you.
And David Bluen, he's an assistant professor of sociology at Indiana University South Bend, where, among other things, he studies human-animal relations and the role of animals in American families. David, once again, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Anita in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hi. I just wanted to say that when I went to Miami University, and this was like almost 30 years ago, there was a gal who had lost her mother young, and she was raised with a German Shepherd puppy practically as her sister. And she had to get special permission to have the puppy with her and the dog by then, in the dorm. And Cindy and her dog were inseparable everywhere around campus, including class. She saw Cindy's dog. It was almost like it was a service animal, but it wasn't. She ended up dating a guy who became a veterinarian, and every year we get Christmas cards, and as their three children were growing, there were always three children and six dogs. And when their children, and I'm a dog lover, and when their children had their own families, they had dogs, so we would get Christmas and Thanksgiving, you know, information from them that we had, you know, the three children, the family, and the 18 dogs or something. I mean, it was amazing, but at that time, it was not, they didn't have dorms that you could have dogs and everything. And it was extraordinary. She was quite a sensation. It was at Miami University in Oxford, and it was quite a sensation on campus. We became friends because I am a dog lover and have kept in touch. And her husband has been in veterinary practice for, you know, since college. And it was really to see short Cindy, tall David, her fiancé, and husband now, and that big German Shepherd wandering around campus. It was not a usual thing at that time. But it was a great, well-behaved dog, very quiet in class. And, I mean, she just wouldn't go away to school without the dog because, as I said, her mother died young, and it was just her father, and her brother, and the dog was like a sister to her. And that's the way she looked at it.
Wow.
Yeah.
You know, David, we were talking earlier about Stetson University having pet-friendly dorms,
right,
and that sort of thing. David, is that pretty common now? Do you know?
To be honest, I don't know for sure. My impression is that it's not. If I could tell a little anecdote,
sure.
A few years ago, I was on the job market looking for a job, and I'd gone to a university in upstate New York for an interview. And I was in a professor's office having a conversation with her, and she had her dog with her in the office. It was a German Shepherd. It was a very friendly dog, and she was obviously very close with her dog. Later that day, I was meeting with the president of the school. It was a small school, and he was interviewing me. And I happened to mention that I'd seen this particular professor and her dog, and he kind of got really quiet and mentioned that she wasn't supposed to have her dog in the office, that they'd talked about that, and she was violating the rules of campus. So, they're not welcome everywhere, but I think that this is something that's changing. But it is a source of contention and conflict sometimes because people have different views and different relationships with animals and different attitudes about them.
Excuse me for interrupting, but I know Cindy had to go through a lot to get that dog on campus. And she actually made it a prerequisite of attending Miami that she wouldn't come without the dog. And they didn't make it easy on her to bring the dog. Now, if it's been a service animal, that might have been different. But I look at it as psychological service is what it was. And she was, I mean, you know, of course, we were all delighted because we had our dogs at home and we missed them. So as I said, we were, you know, it was wonderful for the rest of us. We enjoyed it in her dorm. That's how we met because we were dorm mates.
Right.
And, you know, we really thought it was great. but it was unusual. It was unusual. Cool. And I don't know that anybody had any allergies or anything. I don't know how they addressed that issue. It was quite some time ago. I don't quite remember. But anyway, I just thought it was so relevant to everything you were talking about.
Yes. So well, thank you for the call.
Yeah. And it worked out really well. Her husband's a great vet.
Thanks, Anita.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Take care. Bye. 614-292-8513 if you'd like to give us a call. And George from Mount Gilead, you're a former veterinarian. You're on the air. Welcome to the show.
I'm still a veterinarian. I'm retired.
Okay.
I would like to take friendly exception to the earlier statement, I think, by Dr. Brandt, that it was a great idea for students to take pets to college with them or have them with them when they're going to school.
Mm-hmm.
Every spring, when the students go home for summer quarter, I think you can document with the Columbus Humane Society or Franklin County Humane Society that there are many, many pets that are just abandoned by irresponsible students.
Right.
I really question that the majority of students are either mature enough or have a living situation that will accommodate to much more than a goldfish or a hamster. And there are certainly exceptions where some students are mature or in a living situation where they can have a pet and properly take care of it. But I would certainly not encourage the majority of students to take pets to college for the sake of the pet. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah, thank you. I was going to bring that up, too, that the issue of kids abandoning pets at the end of the semester. That is common, and it's not new.
Absolutely, and it's an excellent point. Obviously, the level of responsibility that any individual has, that would be a decision that they would have to make, and it would not be appropriate for just everybody.
I think the operative word in that statement was kids.
Oh, yeah, I always do that.
many freshmen or even senior college students are not mature enough to properly care for a pet when they're busy and very much engaged in college classes and activities.
George, what do you think about the pet-friendly dorms where maybe there's a little bit more structure associated with the idea of this?
I don't really know enough about them, but first of all, you know, the students in class or on campus away from their room for many hours a day, what's that pet going to be doing?
Mm-hmm.
They need interaction. Cats perhaps would adapt to it more easily than mm-hmm. dogs. I often suggest to people living in a residential environment, if they're going to get a cat, and they're going to be away a lot, to get two so they can keep each other company, so to speak. In fact, I recommend that for people that aren't going to be away a lot. I think getting two kittens that can bond and keep each other company for periods of time works out fairly well. But it takes a mature person, whether they're having a four-legged companion or a new two-legged introduction to the home, to provide proper parenting.
Okay. All right, George, thanks for your call.
Well, thank you for taking my call.
You bet. David, Jennifer, do you want to speak to what George said anymore?
I could make a comment,
mm-hmm.
And I'd actually like to go back to a statement that was made by a previous caller when he mentioned that he feels more sympathetic towards homeless animals than homeless people. And I think sometimes you see these types of questions that fall along these lines. The most recent caller seemed concerned about the welfare of the animals or the pets primarily, or that was the gist of his criticism or concern, whereas some people would support such programs because they feel like having animals, pets, dogs, and cats in a dormitory or in some type of institution is helpful for the people. And not to say that, these types of kind of conflicts always rest on, who are you most concerned about, the animals or the people, but sometimes they do. And so obviously I'm in support of, supporting programs that are kind of mutually beneficial. How do we support pet keeping, animal companionship, guardianship in ways that's helpful for both people and for animals?
Jennifer, do you want to?
Okay, I agree. I think if we can balance both needs,
right,
and have ethical, responsible ownership, I think that's incredibly important.
Danny from Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Ann. I appreciate it.
Mm-hmm.
I want to make a comment about experience that I had gone through with a relationship with a woman who had always owned two dogs that I knew about. When you would go up to the front door, the dogs would come to the door barking like crazy. You would have to go down basically on your knees to be able to calm them down. That was the one thing. The biggest problem I had was when we would sit down on a couch, the dogs would have to be by her. One in particular was always on her lap every minute. And that bothered me. And I would ask her, you know, is it possible, you know, we don't see each other that often, could you take your animals and maybe put them over to the side? And that never happened. That went on for years and years. And I just, you know, just asked for a little bit of time, but she just seemed like she didn't want to do it. I wasn't blaming the dogs.
Mm-hmm.
I was blaming, you know, my friend. And I just could never understand why that can be. And I know that she dearly loved those dogs as children. If you could comment on that, I'd appreciate it.
And it ruined the relationship. You ended up...
Well, let's put it this way. It was one of the factors that I finally decided that I just couldn't take this anymore.
Smart guy, Danny, or Jennifer?
I love animals.
Yeah.
And so that's not a problem there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we actually often hear that. And that's really in any relationship, especially new relationships when you're negotiating boundaries, where the pets play a role in the dating process, et cetera, are important factors. And it sounds like in this relationship, you know, regardless of whether it was about a pet or not, it doesn't sound like your needs were considered primary. And that
exactly.
may have been really the root of it. And
right.
that often does show up in terms of the relationship that people have with their animals.
Right. I agree with that. That's exactly how I looked at it.
Well, Danny, thanks for your call.
Okay, thank you.
Take
Bye-bye.
Care.
Thank
Bye-bye.
You.
We have an email from Kelly, writes, having been laid off for approximately 5 months, I can say with certainty that my beagle has been a lifesaver. I honestly cannot imagine getting through many an uneventful day of job hunting without my inherently loyal and loving four-legged child, Toby. You know, a lot of people have to, because of the layoffs and the economic downturn, have had to get rid of their dogs, I know. That's been another
yes.
influx, source of influx into the shelters.
Yes, it has been.
So, Kelly, that's happy. I'm glad. I'm glad for you. 614-292-8513. If you'd like to give us a call, if you want to join the conversation, we're talking about humans and their pets and what makes that such a strong relationship. And Lee, you're on the air.
Hi, Ann. I'm a pastor in a local church, and as part of my ministry, two of my dogs are registered therapy dogs. And so I take them to nursing homes and assisted living and individual homes to people who are, you know, want to see the dogs. One of my dogs is a Labrador Retriever that we rescued. She had as a puppy, she had a broken leg. The leg had to be amputated. And not too long ago, I was going down the hall of one of the local nursing homes, and there was a man in a wheelchair, and he saw Molly, that's the name of the dog, coming down the hall, and he said, "She's missing a leg." And then he said, "So am I." Mm-hmm. And that dog sat down beside him, and he rubbed her head, and the rapport between the two of them was incredible. And every time I go in there, I take Molly to see this man, and he is so delighted to see her. There's just such a common bond between them that the animal brings that I don't think very few people could bring.
How do animals know? You know, we had a pet when I was growing up, a standard poodle that we would pretend like we were crying just so she would come up and lick our face and try to make us feel better. What is that about, particularly dogs?
I believe that they have a, if you want to call it a sixth sense or something. I had a man who was really worried about his spouse who was in the hospital, and he came to my house and he sat in a chair. He was crying, and one of my golden retrievers came up to him, looked at him, and then stood on his hind legs and put a paw on each shoulder and looked into his eyes. I mean, as a pastor, I had to say nothing.
Right.
The dog said everything.
Right. Well, Lee, thank you for that story.
Okay,
that's wonderful.
Thank you. Mm-hmm, bye.
The last time I had a root canal, my endodontist had, the one time before that, I noticed she had a dog, a Bichon Frise, and it was very well behaved. It didn't yip or anything like that. But this time, the second time I went in, I knew everybody a little bit better, and I asked, geez, you know, whose idea was it to have a dog in here? It turned out it was a specially trained dog. It was a therapy dog. It was there to make me feel better about having a hole drilled down my tooth. I loved having him there. Is that getting to be more common now? Jennifer, do you know?
It is. I mean, the more and more people are having therapy dogs go into a variety of settings. And what the research is showing is that it doesn't just benefit the person who is the owner or the guardian of that pet, but it, in a classroom environment, it may benefit everyone there by reducing stress and lowering blood pressure and just providing a greater overall sense of well-being.
David, do people describe it that way, that they just feel better about their pets? It's not even so much that they're in some kind of relationship. They just know that they feel better around their pets?
Absolutely. Yeah, I heard story after story similar to the one that the pastor shared. You know, when they were going through difficult times, maybe suffering from depression, their dog helped them pull through, or, you know, recovering from the loss of a human child, that their dog was instrumental in helping them cope and deal with that. So, you know, dogs are, I mean, these attachments are very deep and emotional and extremely important for people. I mean, they, almost everyone I spoke with, regardless of which of these categories they fit into, did appreciate the fact that dogs are so loving. And in some ways, in a way that's unique than the type of love that humans can provide. I mean, they're non-judgmental. Mm-hmm. They're, you know, they'll love you regardless of who you are, what you look like. And most everybody, I think, who has a dog appreciates that.
We have an email from Diane. She writes, "We are about to get a puppy for my older child who has some social issues, few friends, etc. His whole effect has changed since we told him of the plan, and he is excited and engaged once again, which I haven't seen since our beloved dog died almost 2 years ago. We feel it will be very good for him to have a pet to greet him after school and to have someone to connect with and feel responsible for. It is very healing, especially for individuals with Asperger's. We weren't quite sure what to do after he leaves for college in 2 years and hope more campuses adopt this attitude." And by the way, as a social worker, I can only say, go social workers. Thank you,
Diane. Wonderful. Since it is National Social Work Month, wonderful.
We have time for just one more phone call. And Colin?
Yeah, hi.
From Clintonville. Welcome to the show.
I'll make it quick. My son, at age 13, had a sudden and severe onset of OCD. We had a 4-year-old corgi, Cardigan, who was very attentive to him. He would stay up till 4 in the morning until we got a diagnosis and medication for about 3 or 4 weeks. The dog would not leave his side. He would stay awake with him, and it really intensified their bond. And the breeder in Canada said they have laws there for mental health concerns that you can have a service dog with you in apartments, and I wondered if there were any laws like that in the United States so that when my son goes to college, he could maybe have a pet with him.
That's a good question. I don't know the answer to that. By the way, OCD is obsessive compulsive disorder.
That's, yes.
Thank you very much for your call.
Sure.
We just have a minute left. I don't know, Jennifer, David?
I can say that they're expanding the definition of what can be a service animal, okay, and that'll be dogs and miniature horses, believe it or not. And so rules are changing. Obviously, somebody would want to investigate where they're going to be living and see if that'd be an option.
Well, Jennifer Brandt, social worker at OSU's College of Veterinary Medicine, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you. My pleasure.
And also David Bluen, assistant professor of sociology at Indiana University in South Bend. Thank you for being with us today.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
Appreciate it. That's all the time we have. Thanks for joining this show. This is All Sides on 89.7. This is WOSU 89.7, WOSU HD1, and WOSU 820 Columbus, and streaming online at WOSU.org, 89.7 NPR News, a service of WOSU Public Media.